for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. 30 years ago, President Ronald Reagan threatened to fire almost 13,000 air traffic controllers unless they called off their strike. He followed through on his threat, firing most of the workers represented by the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization. In a new book, Georgetown University history professor Joseph McCartin describes the circumstances behind Reagan's confrontation with PATCO. The title of his new book is Collision Course. He joins me in the studio to talk about how the strike changed America. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning to you. It's good to have you here.
Good morning, Diane. It's a pleasure to be here.
You called the PATCO strike the most important event in the past half century of labor relations. Today, unionized postal workers are and everybody else who's unionized is being blamed for what's happening in our country. How do you see it?
I think that's right. And I think a lot of this goes back to PATCO. No other strike in American history, in recent history at least, in the past half century, had the impact that that event had. No strike was as broad geographically. It included everyone who worked in air traffic control from Maine to Puerto Rico to Guam to Alaska and every place in between. It was covered by television media and every outlet. It was an extremely public event and became more so because of the president's immediate involvement in it and because of that threat that he made that you just alluded to and because of what he did in following through on that threat 48 hours later.
It's fascinating to read his historical activity regarding unions and then see what he did with PATCO.
Indeed, there's a real deep irony in what happened between Ronald Reagan and the air traffic controllers, because as most of your readers or your listeners might well be familiar, Ronald Reagan was a union leader himself earlier in his career, president of the Screen Actors Guild. In 1952, he led the first strike of actors in that union against the studios. In fact, Reagan even alluded to this at the time of PATCO. He distinguished between strikes in the private sector, as in Hollywood, say, from those in the public sector. But Reagan was a union man early in his career, and that a former union leader dealt such a sharp and decisive blow to the labor movement was deeply ironic.
What was the differentiation he made between public and private workers?
His argument was that in government you can't stop the assembly line, that there are certain jobs that have to happen. And he did not believe that air traffic controllers and other federal workers ought to have the right to collectively withhold their labor and go on strike.
Didn't he have a good point?
I think he did. But what he did not understand was the 20 years of frustration and conflict that led up to the walkout in 1981. He had very little appreciation for that or understanding of it. And he did not understand how his deadline would in fact be counterproductive if he really wanted to get those folks back to work. Many of those strikers, I should say, agreed in principle with Ronald Reagan. They didn't want a strike, but they felt there was no other way to get the government's attention.
What were the working conditions they were striking against?
Well, air traffic control is a uniquely stressful profession. Air traffic controllers handle the lives of people just as surely as pilots do. But unlike pilots, they aren't seen and aren't recognized. When you land somewhere and you get off the plane, the pilot appears at the door of the cockpit and you can say thank you. And you can express your appreciation. The air traffic controllers labor unseen in radar rooms far from airports and in the behind the tinted glass of control towers. They have just as much responsibility for safety as pilots do. They have just as much stress. But in those days, they felt they had very little recognition for all of that, and that was a main factor in motivating their strike.
Now, I hate to remind you of this, yes, but there have been some recent incidents, mm-hmm, where air traffic controllers have been found sound asleep, mm-hmm, so that perhaps, as you outline, their work schedule at the time Ronald, mm-hmm, Reagan fired the union, broke up the union, conditions have changed more, mm-hmm, than a little bit.
They have changed, and I would say they've improved. But some of the problems that linger from 1981, in fact, help to explain some of those recent incidents. There's been a wave of retirements in recent years of controllers who were hired to replace the strikers in 1981. Controllers have been stretched thin. The number of senior controllers who are there to mentor the new incoming controllers, it's a smaller proportion than used to be. The stresses still remain. It's a job that requires people to take some time away from position and rest to be able to keep alert. Now, there have been some unfortunate cases where people have abused that. I think the union now, which is called the National Air Traffic Controllers Association, NATCA, has worked with the FAA to try to rectify that problem.
Tell me about conditions at the time. What was it like for the members of PATCO?
Conditions, I would like to go back to talk about the origins of all of this in the 60s. And at that time, controllers were working mandatory overtime. They were working 6 days a week often, well more than 40 hours, many times not getting breaks away from their radar positions. It was that kind of condition that led to the formation of the union in 1968. Conditions improved marginally between 68 and 81, but there were still some serious problems in the system that controllers wanted to try to rectify.
And enforced overtime meant that at times, you know, even beyond the 6 days a week, some were forced to work very long hours.
That's right. Often you didn't know when your supervisor would need you to stay late. You'd learn that day, or you'd be called in from work while you were home. The other thing about controllers and their work patterns, and this helps to explain the problem of sleeping, is that they tend to rotate through a day shift, then an evening shift, and then a midnight shift over the period of about 5 or 6 weeks. And so that rotation throws off their sleep schedule and makes it often pretty hard for them.
Now, is that the way it is right now, or is that the way it was back then?
That's the way it was then, but in some parts of this job haven't changed because the nature of the job remains the same. You need to staff these facilities 24 hours, and so it does require people to sometimes observe odd schedules.
Take us back to 1935, Joseph McCartin, when federal workers actually gained the right to unionize.
Well, actually, Diane, it wasn't 1935. Many people do assume that. In 1935, just about every private sector worker who was an industrial worker, not an agricultural or domestic or government worker, got the right to organize as a result of the Wagner Act. But government workers were actually left out. They were left out until the late 50s and the 1960s, and it was President John F. Kennedy in 1962 in his executive order 10988 that for the first time opened up the possibility for bargaining in the federal sector, although, as I argue in the book, that order was deeply flawed and it didn't work. It didn't give what it promised. That is, it promised some level of bargaining, but it didn't offer the means through which to bring that about. And that was part of the frustration that began to build in the 60s. So government workers didn't have rights really before the 60s. They started to get them then. But the air traffic controllers who were facing very difficult conditions really thought that couldn't happen fast enough.
So, in fact, the postal workers were operating under totally different rules from, say, PATCO.
Right up until 1970, postal workers, air traffic controllers, and others operated under the same basic umbrella of the law. But in 1970, about 300,000 postal workers staged a wildcat strike. That is, a strike that wasn't approved by their union leaders, protesting some of their conditions and what they felt was their low pay. That strike instigated reform that led to the creation of the U.S. Postal Service, where the postal workers were actually broken out of the federal government and set up in a separate self-funding agency. Now, they achieved at that time, 1970 and 71, the right to bargain over their pay. But other federal workers didn't get that right, including PATCO. And in fact, it was the postal workers' example in 1970 and 71 that really was in PATCO's mind in the 1970s. They wanted to achieve what the postal workers had won.
And why couldn't they?
Well, that's the question that they persistently asked, and they never felt that they got a proper answer to it. Neither Democratic nor Republican administrations were very anxious to extend bargaining rights of that sort to their workers. I think one of the things that happened was, as the economy began to run into trouble in the mid-1970s, at the time that Jimmy Carter was in the White House and when they conceivably could have gotten reform, economic conditions persuaded Carter to oppose that idea.
Collision Course is the name of Joseph McCartin's new book. We'll be right back. In his new book, Collision Course, Joseph McCartin of Georgetown University takes us back to Ronald Reagan, the air traffic controllers, and the strike that changed America. Do join us, 800-433-8850. You talk about Jack Mayer and
yes.
Mike Rock. Who were they, Joe?
They were the two men who founded PATCO. And the event that launched them on this quest was a terrible tragedy, which speaks to the kind of conditions that they were trying to deal with. On December 16, 1960, Jack Maher and Mike Rock, then recently out of the military and not long into their FAA jobs, were working in Hangar 11 at Idlewild Airport. And it was a big hangar within which there were many radar screens where controllers monitored and directed traffic around the New York metropolitan area. That was a very bad weather day, and on that day, two planes came together, crashed together in a mid-air collision over Staten Island, a DC-8 from Chicago, and Super Constellation from Ohio. 134 people were killed in that horrific event. To that point in American history, it was the worst air disaster ever. It galvanized the controllers. To them, it demonstrated what they'd been privately complaining about for a couple of years. That is that their equipment was outdated. They were often working with radar screens that came off of decommissioned battleships. They were understaffed, and You know, although controller error was not, you know, the cause of this strike, it was later found that one of the pilots had violated the instructions he'd been given. Had the radar screens been working better and procedures been better, the event might have been avoided. Jack Maher especially was deeply affected by this because he directed one of those planes before handing it off to another controller. He was subpoenaed and testified in the investigation that followed, and he was so offended by how the event was handled. He felt that the government covered up the problems within air traffic control, that they had no interest of exposing those to the public. And he said, we've got to change this. And so it was really that event that got them started on the organizing effort that took them really 8 years to come to fruition before they could actually form PATCO.
I wonder whether they faced challenges from their own employers.
They did.
Big time.
They did. The FAA, as soon as they began to try to organize and to bring attention to these issues, the FAA made clear in no uncertain terms that they did not appreciate that. They did not believe it was the job of everyday controllers like Rock and Maher to be involved in these kinds of things, and basically told them to stop. And they had great difficulty finding, people who would stand with them, and that led them to one of the more interesting and strange twists of this story. In the end, they felt like they needed a very prominent public figure to come in and help them get this thing off the ground who could speak for them. They ended up approaching the attorney, F. Lee Bailey, and persuading him, as a great trial lawyer, also an amateur pilot, to help them. Bailey heard their story. He was also appalled by what they told him, and he said, I'll help you. And he helped them found the organization.
Interesting. We have an email from Mark in Miami who says, I'm a management, labor, and employment lawyer. Reagan merely followed the law, saying you cannot strike. It's nothing extraordinary, says Mark.
He did follow the law. There's nothing untrue about that. But it was extraordinary. No other president had done this. There had been 39 work stoppages in the federal government between 1962 and 1981. Now, granted, none of them were as large as this one. But one of them had actually been undertaken by air traffic controllers. When Richard Nixon was president in 1970, after they had formed PATCO and found that they weren't getting anywhere with the FAA, they staged a sick out. It was basically a strike, where controllers for 3 weeks called in sick, about 3,000 of them. Now, Richard Nixon could have done what Ronald Reagan did and fired them all, but he didn't. In fact, he tried to fire only a very few, fewer than 100 of the leaders of that sick out. But in the end, he even ended up pardoning those and allowing them to be rehired or opening the door to their rehiring. So no one ended up being fired, although they'd basically done the same thing in 1970. Yes, Reagan followed the law, but he also did this in a way no other president did, and by doing it that way, set a dramatic precedent.
You know, it's fascinating. Someone sent in a message on Facebook. It was Walter who said, unions are always under attack, while only 6% of private sector unions, workers, are unionized.
Well, Walter has a good point. I mean, if you listen to some of labor's critics these days, they keep talking about big labor, but labor's not so big as it used to be.
And Mike has written that, Michael Moore has written that this is the day the middle class and the American dream died.
You know, there's a little bit of hyperbole in that, but there's also a bit of truth in it. As I argue in the book, this particular event had an enormous impact in undermining workers' ability to exercise collective action. Once Ronald Reagan established the precedent for breaking a strike on this magnitude, it was imitated in the private sector to the point where strikes, which had been commonplace as a method of workers to get their demands met before 1981, about 270 major strikes a year on average in that period have almost disappeared from the American industrial landscape in recent years. There were only 13 major strikes in 2009, for example, down from 270-some. So as workers have lost the ability to win gains by using collective action, clearly this has opened the door to management and employers putting more health care costs onto their shoulders, keeping down wages and other things.
And yet Barbara writes, had Reagan not confronted the traffic controllers, there would have been a much larger outcry. This was hardly the day the middle-class American dream died. There are plenty of reasons for that, greed being one.
Well, she also has a point, too. No single event can explain everything, although I think this was a kind of a catalytic event. However, of course, Ronald Reagan did have to act in some way, and actually, I think even a Democratic president would have refused to negotiate with air traffic controllers who were engaged in an illegal strike. Langhorne Bond, who was Jimmy Carter's FAA administrator, had actually drawn up the plan to be able to defeat a strike, and he wanted to stay on in that post so that he could defeat a strike if one happened, and he believed that Carter would not negotiate in the face of a strike.
But was it Johnson's head of the FAA who actually agreed to meet with the union, which was unprecedented?
That is right. As PATCO was built against great odds in the 1960s and finally formed in a convention in Chicago in January, in New York, actually, in January 1968, the union embarked on its first effort to pressure the FAA by slowing down air traffic in order to force that meeting. And so it was Lyndon Johnson's director of the FAA, Bozo McKee, who met with representatives of the air traffic controllers in 1968. And for the first time, controllers found that only by pressuring the government could they sit down with the top people in their agency and get them to listen.
So what was PATCO asking for as Ronald Reagan saw it, and what was he willing to give them?
Well, both of those questions are interesting. PATCO made a severe miscalculation in trying to draw up its demands for 1981 because it made it as its central demand the idea that air traffic controllers ought to get a $10,000 raise across the board, every controller. Now, that was at a time when the average salary was $32,000. So it was a hugely unrealistic demand. The union never really felt that they would get that, but they wanted to make
a
point.
Have a negotiating place.
That's exactly right. And Reagan people never thought that they would give anything near that either. But what the Reagan negotiators did, which I think has been forgotten, is that they actually went pretty far toward trying to address the controllers by offering for the first time to raise their salaries. Now, no previous administration had ever done that in a negotiation. As I said, federal workers didn't really have that right. But what they offered was too small, the union felt. And actually, they misread Reagan. They felt that his offer of a precedent-setting salary increase was an indication that if they pushed him a little more, they could get more from him.
What else was PATCO asking for that they thought they could get and that perhaps Reagan might have agreed to?
They wanted a shorter work week. That was a key demand. And a number of other things, relief from the stresses of their jobs.
How could they have gotten that kind of relief from the stress of the job?
They felt if their work weeks were reduced, that this would help mitigate that stress. Actually, what the Reagan people did offer was a paid lunch break for the first time, and that was a significant step. But again, the union misread Reagan. And actually, part of that goes back to another interesting part of this story, and that is that PATCO actually endorsed Ronald Reagan in 1980. Many people forget that. It was one of only four unions that did endorse Reagan.
And William writes to us and says, the crying shame is that union members voted for Reagan, even though if they had paid attention to his time as governor and what he said on the campaign trail, they would have realized he was anti-union, so they slit their own throats. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I think it's a little exaggerated. There's some truth in it, but I think it's overstated. I think one thing about Ronald Reagan as governor is that you could make two different kind of cases. Was he anti-labor? If you looked at his treatment of Cesar Chavez and the farm workers, you would say, yes, he was. He did not help them. Was he anti-labor? If you looked at his treatment of public workers in California, I'm not sure you could say that. He actually signed a bill in 1968 that brought collective bargaining to local workers within California, the Myers-Milius-Brown Act.
Interesting. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Earl.
Hey, good morning. I'm one of the 12,000 brothers and sisters that walked on August the 3rd, and we just celebrated our 30th anniversary. And, sir, I want you to know that I pre-ordered your book. I'm going to critique it for you.
Thank you.
It was an interesting time in our life. I'm very proud of what we stood for. I'm very proud of our actions and the way we carried ourselves. And I got to tell you that the air traffic controller today has gained tremendously from our strike. Salaries are over $100,000 when they reach the full performance level. They still have some of the work issues as far as you were mentioning about the rotating shifts and whatnot, which is very, very difficult on you. But one of the things that the strike brought along was delaying air traffic because of they didn't have enough controllers to handle the flights after the strike, and they came up with these plans such as ground delay programs and ground stops, things that we didn't have when we were working traffic. We just dealt with it as it came and did our jobs the best we could.
I think Earl is right. And one point that I would touch on and underline is the irony in the fact that these 11,000-some strikers who were fired did clearly help improve things for those who now work in air traffic control. Their salaries and other things about the job have been dramatically improved, I would say, compared to what it was before 1981. A lot of that has to do with what those strikers did.
All right, to Stephen in Delray, Florida. Good morning, you're on the air. I guess you're not. To Dover, New Hampshire. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Diane. And I have to say, this is the first time I've listened to your program. It's definitely very enlightening and very intellectual. I do appreciate your program.
Thank you.
I have a fundamental question for your guest, and it's a question. I am a conservative, but I do have an open mind, and so my question is a little bit more fundamental on collective bargaining. FDR basically pondered out loud how collective bargaining could not be corrupted by the political process if you give public workers collective bargaining rights. One of the things that is kind of a question for me, and I'm sure for leaders such as FDR, was, you know, when you're dealing with taxpayer money and the parties around the negotiating table are those of workers and those of elected officials, how that process actually is a good thing for people who are actually paying the bills. So if your guest can address that would be great.
Sure. Thanks for calling.
Well, Michael has a really good and important question, and this is a question people are debating today. My argument is that collective bargaining in government works. It's worked pretty effectively over more than a half century in the places where it's been. We shouldn't immediately assume that it becomes a corrupt system where unions support politicians who end up paying them back by improving their conditions and wages, et cetera, at the public's expense. And politicians still have to defend whatever they do to the public.
That is Rush Limbaugh's argument,
right,
that public unions simply are forced to take their dues and give them back to elected officials.
That is the argument, but I think it's inaccurate. Say in the federal government, nobody is required to pay the union anything to be represented by the union.
Joseph McCartin, his new book is titled Collision Course. We'll take a short break and be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, whose Kids Count report provides state-level data on the well-being of kids and families at aecf.org. By the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, providing resources to improve the quality of health care, online at rwjf.org/consumer. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, three firefighters tell their 9/11 stories. Jay Jonas was on the fourth floor of the World Trade Center's North Tower when it collapsed around him. Ken Haskell lost two brothers who were also firefighters. Retired firefighter Dennis Smith collects their stories and others in his new book, Decade of Hope. Join us.
We'll go right back to the phones to Vades, Kentucky, and Lucinda. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you so much for having Joseph McCartney on this subject. My ex-husband was a air traffic controller until 1979 when he took a disability and retired. They knew there was a problem with negotiations coming up. They'd had conventions. They discussed this. Sir, I'd like to ask you, do you have two things, a copy of the letter that he, President Reagan, sent to the PATCO members to asking for his vote and promising that he would help them during their negotiation and the next contract talks? Number two, do you have a copy of the FAA whitewash it was a softback paper pamphlet, I had it one time, it's about a half an inch thick, where the FAA, the government, published a whitewash of the steps that led up to the strike and why they handled it that way. Number three, they were never given arbitration. They never sent in top echelon negotiators to the PATCO controllers. I went to their one of their meetings, and that was one of the major complaints is they had all these.
Right.
Lucinda has some good questions. Yes, I have read and talk about in my book the October 20th, 1980 letter from Ronald Reagan to PATCO, which sealed the endorsement that the union subsequently made of Reagan's candidacy 3 days later. The letter doesn't specifically say what it will do for PATCO, but it's filled with statements that indicate support from Reagan for PATCO's concerns. There were negotiations that preceded that letter in which the union felt that it was being promised significant things from the Reagan administration. They obviously misread any indications that they read that way, though, because they thought that they were being promised more than actually the Reagan people were prepared to give them. But that letter was widely circulated among controllers prior to the strike, and it helped to fuel the feeling among them that, hey, we were promised something by this president. What they've offered at the bargaining table is pretty small, and it doesn't really address our fundamental concerns. And that's partly why they decided we're going to walk out.
What about the FAA pamphlet?
I've read reports by the FAA. I'm not sure which one Lucinda is referring to. There were many studies afterward, including one actually commissioned by Drew Lewis, Secretary of Transportation under Reagan, which reviewed the circumstances leading to the strike and actually came out quite critically against the FAA. That report really faulted FAA management style for increasing a sense of alienation and conflict in the workplace.
And what about arbitration?
Arbitration wasn't really a possibility in this conflict for a simple reason, and that is what was being talked about and what the union wanted Reagan to do was outside the scope of what the law should have allowed. That is, the law didn't allow air traffic controllers to be able to bargain over their salaries. The union wanted to do that. Reagan was offering to do it. You couldn't really bring an arbitrator into that situation because there was no provision in the law for it.
Lucinda, I'm glad you called. Thank you. To Indianapolis and Chester. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I'd just like to say I love your program. You're the greatest.
Thank you.
Don't want to bore you with that, but I was a controller for 11 years, 81, and there were some incidents, I think, that got the people to go and strike. The controllers were naive when it came to labor and as far as the labor unions were. One of them was the letter promise that they got that the administration would support them. And at the time, the raises that we should have been gotten should have been based on a consumer price index, and we were like 26% below where we should have been earning. And that was one of the things that the administration said they would correct in, you know, the pre-election promises. And then after, they said, well, that was a campaign promise. You know, you didn't expect us to follow through with that. But what really got some of these people, a lot of these controllers were veterans. Many were Vietnam veterans who had sacrificed a lot. I mean, they were dedicated federal employees, but to have their government make promises like that or a political party and then turn around and stick it to them, it made it a little easier to energize the base and get them worked up over it. And there's enough evidence maybe behind that to see that it was intended to break a union. You couldn't do it in private. J. Lynn Helms, who was the FAA administrator, if you go back through his resume and look at the stuff that he, how he got into politics, and by the way, he was indicted for lying to Congress. That was one of the reasons they got some people, that was after the fact, but one of the reasons they got the controllers fired up was the promises that they didn't make. I still have a copy of that letter.
Chester, it's really interesting to hear that firsthand experience, that on-the-scene view.
Absolutely. And like Chester, many of the fired strikers that I've met over the years carry a copy of that letter in their wallet, folded up.
Tell me about what happened in Wisconsin. What's going on there?
Right. Well, I think it's one of the ways in which the PATCO strike continues to resonate and ramify through our politics. Back in January, Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin called his staff together, and he had a dinner with them just prior to going to the legislature with a bill. in which he was going to call for rolling back collective bargaining rights for Wisconsin workers. He sat the staff down. He pulled out a picture of Ronald Reagan. This is by his own account. He said, folks, you know, 30 years ago, Ronald Reagan had a history-changing confrontation with PATCO, and now it's our time to seize history. And so he went to the Wisconsin legislature, and ultimately, after a long struggle that took weeks, as we all know,
in which some legislators left town.
That's right. Some left town and hid in Illinois for a little time, but Walker was able to get his bill enacted. Now, that's generated lots of fights for recalls for the legislators on either side of that, and for Walker himself, and his is yet to be decided. But I think what's significant about it is that what Scott Walker did in Wisconsin is really far beyond what Ronald Reagan ever did, and it shows how radical anti-unionism has become in the past 30 years. Ronald Reagan was not an opponent of public sector collective bargaining per se. As I said, as governor, he extended it in California. He also offered PATCO some money to raise their salaries in 1981 when no other president did that. So Reagan never campaigned against collective bargaining the way Scott Walker is doing. And yet now latter-day Reagan followers want to claim Ronald Reagan as the first and greatest anti-unionist.
Here is a posting on Facebook from Kenneth, who started his 30-year career with the National Labor Relations Board in 79. He says, although my agency does not deal with public employees, I recall the PATCO strike, its lasting effects in the private sector. One reason I am against SB 5 in Ohio, which would restrict or eliminate collective bargaining rights for Ohio's public employees. He says, what happens in the public sector often rolls down to the private sector.
Oh, absolutely. And you could say that Kenneth's last statement is almost a motto for my book and what I show in this book. That is, what happened to government workers in 1981 had a huge impact in the private sector. Arguably, it had a much bigger impact in the private sector than it did in the public sector. As the previous caller noted, you know, controllers today are unionized. They have won things as a result of that 1981 strike. But in the private sector, once Reagan broke PATCO, there was a wave of strike breaking that happened among private sector workers that, again, has basically eliminated the strike as a viable tool for unions today.
But isn't that the major tool that unions have always had at their disposal? And how strong can they be without that ability?
It's an important point. Nobody wants to be a champion of strikes, but actually strikes have served a purpose. When management is unwilling to listen and there's no other way, and unreasonable, and there's no other way to get their attention, then the withholding of labor is really labor's last great resort. Now, once you remove that possibility from unions, then they increasingly have to do what you've seen in recent years. They have to turn to politics as a way of protecting and advancing their interests. And that has fed a cycle which has further polarized our politics today.
All right. To Bedford, Texas. Good morning, Carolyn.
Good morning, Diane. Back during the PATCO strike, I was a very young and somewhat naive union rep. I was a flight attendant at the time. I still am, and I'm still involved in my union. I remember attending a PATCO rally right outside of the airport property, and all of the airport unions, pilots unions, flight attendants, mechanics, baggage handlers, and quite a few others there in Los Angeles were at the rally talking about, ain't it awful, isn't it just dreadful, wringing their hands. And we marched around the airport property in support of PATCO. My question to you is, had those unions honored that PATCO picket line for just 24 hours, would the recent history of American labor union be substantially different?
Interesting question.
It's a great question that Carolyn has. It's a question that labor activists continue to ask 30 years later. The labor movement faced a very difficult situation. Ronald Reagan was a popular president. The strike was illegal. Leaders of the labor movement, like Lane Kirkland, did not believe that they could rally even a majority of union members into actions like this. They thought it might divide their unions. They were afraid to try to do that, especially when the two unions that were closest to the air transport system at the time, the pilots union and the machinists union, didn't take leadership and say, we're going to go on strike or to honor these picket lines. And so everybody waited for somebody else to do something, and nothing really happened.
I thank you for your call, Carolyn.
Thank you so much for all you do for us, Diane.
Thank you. And to Keith in Fairport, New York, good morning.
Good morning, Diane. I'm very interested in this discussion that you've had this morning. And I've thought for a very long time that what happened to the private sector unions after the air traffic controller strike, once Reagan was able to fire those people and get away with it, as soon as he fired those folks, the private sector unions should have brought the country to a total halt. Teamsters, iron workers, dock workers, you name it, they should have all gone on strike in support of this and recognized it for what it really was. This was union breaking at its nth degree. And Ronald Reagan read his popularity correctly and said, you know what? I'm willing to take you right to the mat with this. So I blame poor union leadership at the national level that was not able to pull the brothers and sisters together and actually do anything about it.
Do you agree with that, Joe?
Well, Keith has a point. I'm not sure I would lay it, though, to simply bad leadership. The American workforce is very diverse and has lots of different interests. It's also divided in lots of ways, religiously, regionally, racially. And to coalesce workers around the cause of other workers in the way that would have been necessary in 1981 was a really steep challenge.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show to Richmond, Virginia. Good morning, Roger.
Yes, thank you. I'm an employee of UPS and, of course, was involved in one of the most successful recent strikes in our nation's history. And at that time, we had the sentiment of the public was behind us. I'm afraid that may not be the case in the future. I was wondering what you might suggest, since strikes are obviously not viable. And politics, we pay millions of dollars and don't get the representation. Other than pool room language at public rallies and tired slogans of "I've got the hammer," wouldn't you suggest going to the legislature and telling them that lack of health benefits and is actually being paid by the state taxpayer?
I think that's right, and I think in your own statement, Roger, you kind of help point the way forward, because what we have to do, I think, is begin to educate people about the problems of the American worker and about the problems that we can't continue to ignore. Rising health costs being offloaded onto workers' backs is bad not just for those workers, it's bad for the whole economy.
And finally, to Ocean City, Maryland. Gene, very quick point, please.
Very quick, because I was a bit involved. I was involved in the training of the air traffic controllers when they prepared for this strike. And I'm sure your author realizes that they were pretty confident because of their relationship with the president at the time. They thought it would be a short strike, and they were very confident. I helped them with skill building on dealing with the media. I had nothing to do with policy. And the other item, I'm not sure it has been mentioned by you, but the leadership of the AFL-CIO didn't know about the actual strike except through the news. The executive committee was meeting in Chicago, and the air traffic controllers went out on strike, so that the entire Federation really had to get behind them as a second thought.
Well, Gene's right. The AFL-CIO wasn't really involved in the planning of this strike. It wasn't really consulted. AFL-CIO leaders were meeting on the morning that the strike began, as Gene points out, in Chicago. It was a really dramatic scene that I recount in the book, because they were kind of in a quandary. What do we do? Here's the president laying a 48-hour ultimatum on workers. We know this strike is not going to be a popular strike. What do we do?
And finally, John in Geneseo, New York, writes, the irony of renaming National as the Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport. Thank you so much for joining us. Joseph McCartan is the author of the new book. It's titled Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Sarah Ashworth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.